Hello and welcome to The Convex Conversation with me, journalist Helen Fospero. Today's guest is the founder and creative director of Quiet Storm Advertising and the Create Not Hate campaign. Trevor Robinson, OBE, sketched and painted as a young boy and was encouraged by his mother to pursue his talent. However, when he was 13, his careers advisor told him he had a better chance of becoming a bus driver than working in the creative industry. Undeterred, he found his way into the ad world and in 1995 founded Quiet Storm, a top 100 agency and one of the first to write, direct and produce its own material for clients like Mercedes-Benz, Young Seafood, Netflix, Gymbox and countless others, as well as one of my favourites, the Haribo Kids Voices campaign.
I just want to talk about this Haribo Star Meets Sweeties.
I like the hearts
because they make me feel love.
And also I like the rings.
And the gold bears.
Because it looks like it's a ring when they go swimming so they don't drown.
Then look, you can make a big, big sandwich.
Trevor, it's great to meet you. What a story. What an ad. Tell me about it.
Hi, Helen. Well, it's kind of like I came up with it. I didn't really come up with it. Mary Sue is a creative that I work with it. And she really was the person that made it happen. Because believe it or not, it's such a simple idea. But our client didn't really understand it. And he said, quite honestly, he goes, when we read it to him in script form, he said, I don't think this is funny and stuff. And we were saying, look, it is really good and all this. And so we had to, luckily we're a production company as well. So we shot it, did a test film. And I must say the test film still now is one of the funniest ones because it was length. We just shot it with the people in the office and it was hilarious. And he showed it to him and he took it and he went back to the office and he showed it to all the people at his office. And he came back and he goes, everybody finds it hilarious. And he just says, even to this day, he says, I still don't see why people find it funny.
I think it's absolutely hysterical. I mean, I still laugh every time I see it. But how did you manage to keep a straight face when you were filming and how did you manage with the kids?
I've got to say, the kids part of it is the hardest part because you've got to get them relaxed and talking, just using their imagination and having fun. And just so you've got to create an environment where they feel at home, they feel comfortable. And that's not easy when you're in a studio and you're trying to do this. And then you've got to get quite creative in order to get them to talk and get things out. But we record them first, so they're just all authentic voices. And then we'll put it to picture. We'll film on another day. So once we've got our 30 seconds or 23 seconds, whatever it is, we'll construct that and then play it on the studio to the actors or wherever we're filming it. And I've got to say that Haribo shoots are always the most fun and pleasant ones that I've ever gone. People always got a big smile on their face. I think it's the nature of it. Normally people just look like it's the worst day of their lives when they're on shoots, but Haribo shoots are always a real, the crew, everybody just seems a lot happier.
I'm afraid I'd eat my body weight in fizzy ones if it was me.
I'm a big Tam Fascott fan, I must say. Yeah, I'm with you there.
Now, your careers advisor advice made me smile because when I was about that age, I went to my careers advisor and I'm from Grimsby. Oh. And I said, I want to be a TV presenter. And without missing a beat, he just looked at me and said, well, no one from Grimsby will ever become a TV presenter, so you need to be a teacher.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, my God. And the rest is history after a 30-year career in broadcasting. So I just wondered what exactly yours said and what was your sort of thought process at the time?
When I was told I was, you know, have a look at working for London Transport, I must admit, she just was trying to be quiet. She knew nothing about advertising. She was just trying to be helpful. And she probably was thinking very similar to your Grimsby story that you've got no chance, mate. So I was obviously quite angry at that stage. But I chose to use it really to prove her wrong and anybody. I've always done that. When people tell me I can't do something, I always don't say much. I just play it back to myself at those low points, especially when I was on the dole for over a year and a half trying to get into advertising with me and Al, jumping from interview to interview, rejection to rejection. I would play back all those people that tell me I'm not going to make it and I'm not very good or whatever. I would use that anger in to try and prove them wrong.
Well, you certainly did prove them wrong. I'm also smiling because not only did I say TV presenter, I said Blue Peter presenter. For many years later, I auditioned for Blue Peter. And I remember thinking about my careers teacher as I was bouncing up and down on the trampoline during the test, the little orange jumpsuit. I came second to Anthea Turner, so there's no prizes for second in my industry. Wow. I saw a lovely picture of you and your mum on the day that you were awarded your OBE. What role did mum play in those early years in terms of encouraging you and enthusing about following your dreams, really?
Yeah, my mum was away. She died a couple of years back. And I was really super pleased that I got to take her to Buckingham Palace. And like, I think she's always been proud of me. I think she was just quite happy I didn't get into trouble, really. I think she's just amazed. I think it took a long time to get her head around what I did for a living. I remember trying to explain. I thought it was dead obvious. See those adverts? We do them. But I remember when I first got in the industry and I was telling my mum about it, and I used the analogy of architecture, and I overheard her telling somebody, oh, my son, he's an architect. Like, all right, this is going to take longer than I thought. But my mum has always been, was always incredibly encouraging, and she's just the archetypal, you know, you die for your mum. I still go and cycle down, see her grave, you know, have a few tears.
Oh, I'm sure you miss her. What was your Buckingham Palace experience like with her, and who gave you the award?
That was really surreal, actually, because it was like, in lots of ways, going to Buckingham Palace, no one, because just going back a bit, they send you a yellow card in an envelope saying, do you want it? You know, OBE, would you like to receive it? And I thought it was somebody winding me up because it didn't look very, you know, you're expecting it to be like, you know, calligraphy with lots of flourishes in it and something like that. It was just on a yellow piece of card and saying, do you want it? And I went, and I thought it was a wind up for my friends because most of my mates know I don't really go in for all that kind of stuff. But I felt really humbled at the concept that I've been recognized by, at that stage, I wasn't really recognized through awards, me and Al won, but not really recognized by our industry, to be recognized by the palace. It was very surreal. I brought my son, my wife and my mum along to it, and they were taken off one way and I was taken off up some stairs. And what's surreal about it, even walking in, it just feels very oppressive. Like the carpets itself walking up the stairs are super thick and the stairs are very wide. So it feels like you're walking up in licorice, you know, and it feels really like odd. And then they've got these beef eaters, but not like the cuddly little beef eaters you see outside Tower Bridge. These guys are standing there with these big axes, full gear, looking really intimidating. And I was trying to make some stupid joke as I walked past one. And he looked at me like, please, say another word, I'll chop your head off. It just looked really surreal. I got my medal from Charlie, and I did a very weird capoeira dance in front of him because I forgot to bow. So I came back to bow, and like all these security guards just looked like, oh no, we've got a live one here. And I bowed, but it kind of looked like some weird dance, according to my son, as I shuffled off. So I've managed to ruin that moment.
What fun. Now, going back again, we're flipping back to mum again. You grew up on the Notre Dame estate in Clapham in South London. Tell me a bit, Trevor, about what home life was like, how many kids there were. And I know mum was a single mum from the age of, well, when you were around 9, wasn't she? So she sort of managed things on her own.
Yeah, my mum and dad got divorced when I was around 9. And it was called the Misery Estate. And it was just something really oppressive about the state. And I think it was one of the main reasons I thought I got to get out of here, because it was a very depressing place. And it was a place where it seems to have people having kids and then those kids would move into the house with them. And then people just didn't seem to leave, you know. And even when I go back there, you still see a lot of people that were there when I was a kid, you know. And it's something really depressing about these people. Back then, Clapham was a horrible old place. I remember when they still had, and that feels quite surreal to think that this was actually on a door, which was no blacks, no dogs, and no Irish.
Oh, my God.
And it was on a pub on Clapham. The pub's gone now. I think they put Sainsbury's there or something now. But I remember that pub, Irish pub, we used to go in there sometimes. We had no money. When we did have money, we'd sneak in there and play snooker, pool. But I just remember that kind of summed up the area, that and riots. Kind of summed up Clapham years ago. It was damn nice now, though.
I read an article where you said you didn't really feel like you were like the rest of your family necessarily. I suppose that fits in a little bit to what you were saying there, because you were a few siblings, weren't there?
Yeah, yeah. But to be honest, we were all completely different. Scott went into building houses and stuff like my dad, and he had his own team, but he was pretty upset about it. And later on, I think he was about 40, discovered he loved doing classes and doing fit classes and running classes. And he was very upset about the fact it's taken him his whole life for him to discover this is what he loves doing. And I said, at least he found it. And my sister Clover, she just kind of put her whole life into her kids. She seems to just have lots of kids and loves her kids and not much room for anybody else in the family that she really cares about other than her own kids. And Winston was a bit of the naughty boy. And I didn't see him for much of my teens because he was in and out of prison for most of his life. So we're all really, really different. You know, like I'm the youngest, so I get on with everybody. I was the only one in the middle that everybody seemed to like.
And your mum did people's hair sort of a bit on the side, didn't she, just to bring a bit of extra cash in? And wasn't that when you were drawing her clients? And
yeah, I used to draw, make comics, make go-karts. I used to always do stuff. And one of the things I used to love doing was portraits. And I used to draw anybody that would come in and sit there because they couldn't move because they're getting their hair done. And I remember thinking back, they must have looked hideous because my mum and being so nice complimented me every time I did anything. And I also love listening to their stories as well. My mum's had a fantastic sense of humour. She just makes me laugh and she's a really great storyteller and you would have loved to interview her. And so I used to just love her talking to her friends and laughing. She had a great laugh and she can really make everybody, including myself, laugh a lot. So it was all round fun thing to do, especially this is before the internet and computer games and all that. My kids, you know, barely see them now. They're locked in their room on their games or Instagramming it or something.
She sounds like she was fiercely protective of you all and also quite feisty at school. Didn't she get into a bit of a confrontation with one of the teachers when she was sticking up for you?
God, did I write that down? Oh,
you might have done.
Yeah. When I was at primary school, we had a teacher called Mr. Ghosh. And he would get quite angry at the class. We had too many kids in the class and everybody was yelling and stuff like that, being kids. And his thing that he'd always do would be to throw his keys at the board for dramatic purpose. And for once, I was actually quiet and I was at the front of the class and trying to learn. And that was very unlike me. I was usually just chatting away with everybody. Or to be honest, I tend to be doodling or drawing or making comics or something. So I'll disappear into my world. So I was not aware of it. And he threw towards the board from the back of the class towards the board, but he missed through and it hit me in the back of the head and it busted my head open. So I just always remembered my mum, quite tough, round woman, marching in with my two brothers either side her. And they didn't do a thing, but she let ripped on this teacher. And poor Mr. Ghosh, he lost his job as well as getting a beating. So,
Poor Mr. Ghosh, oh dear. I hope he's all right now, wherever he is.
He's all right now. All his wounds are healed by now.
So from your doodling and your comic making and that kind of sort of growing up, how did you get into the world of advertising in the first place?
Well, when I went to college, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And I must admit, I did advertising as a part of all the different things I did because I did a bit of fashion, a bit of graphic designing. I thought about going into being an artist at one stage. When I was on the dole, I used to do freelance book covers, design book covers, but I also used to be a court artist. So I do, you know, the people that come in and draw. And I remember drawing Jeffrey Archer. Yeah, and it was really scary. Anyway, I was on the dole, and basically when I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do when I was at college, I thought I can't do advertising because the idea of having to come up with new, fresh ideas every day, I just thought that's impossible. How can you do that? And I really didn't think this would be the kind of career that I would eventually chosen. I went to two interviews. One was for animation and the other was for Below the Line Advertising Agency in Richmond. To be honest, was hoping I'd get the animation one more, but the other one came up and I didn't get the animation one. So I ended up being in this Below the Line place where I met my creative partner for years and years, Al Young. And I started to get I think it's had a lot to do with the guys that were there as well, because it was a little bit of like elephant's graveyard kind of place. These guys had once worked in the West End and now ended up at this place just making as much money as they can on overtime and stuff. And they were quite bitter and they kept talking about the advertising industry and sneering at it and talking about it, and almost made these guys into heroes in a way when I was listening to them, because they were talking about knowing these guys. And one of the things started happening as well, because I knew I had to get a book that would be good enough to get me into the West End. And my portfolio wasn't good. It was just like adverts for pile cream and stuff like that, because it was a pharmaceutical company.
Glamorous stuff.
It was very glamorous. It was so good. I started working on my portfolio overnight with Tom Carty and Walter Campbell. Tom was at Dorland's and he's a postboy, I think, and Walt was had a job, a little legitimate job there. But it did make me laugh though, because it was really funny. He said he never did anything at college. He took all the, a piece of every at the exhibition, all the best pieces from the exhibition, he nicked it, came to London and he had them in his portfolio and showed it, and he got his job doing that. And Tom was a postboy and Walt was working with somebody else, and Tom was a postboy, and Tom was our kind of Captain Ahab, really. He was like, right, we'd all do these fictitious briefs and then we'll all assess, and Tom would be like creative director and kind of say if it's good or bad, or it's been done, it's a DNAD 2 years ago. Anyway, he was like, he's quite a really funny character as well. And he used to stick the best piece of work, his best pieces of work, underneath the desks of the creators that work there. And he would kind of go, no, they don't even know they've got genius underneath their own desk. He used to really make me laugh. So I started getting really into the idea of getting into the West End, into advertising. Then, really, I started realising I could do it. And even when I was at college, I was surprised to get quite high marks on my advertising, because I used to bunk off a lot at college. I just was not designed to be a student, really. I used to bunk around to other colleges, because this is the days they didn't really have security on the door. You could just walk in. So I'd just walk into the lessons or at St. Martin's, Camberwell College, LCP, and just go and sit in the lectures and sit in the lessons. So my portfolio was all over the shop, really, by the time I went to my exhibition.
Did you feel that that world was right for you when you started there? Did you think, yes, I've found myself, this is where I want to be?
When I got into advertising? Yeah. I mean, like, I can't explain it. It's like, and I still pinch myself that people give me money to do something I find quite enjoyable, actually coming up with ideas. You know, and like I get to film my own ideas and I get to work with talented, smart people. And you see your work on like one of the biggest ego things I've ever had is walking into a cinema. The adverts were on first and it was an old Apple Tango ad that we had on the screen. And the whole audience was just laughing their heads off. And I sort of like sat there and I just thought, God, I really wanted to stand up and go, oh, I did that.
Was it the Apple Tango seduction campaign?
Yes.
I think I read somewhere, I have read a lot about you, Trent.
Oh, wow.
That you were quoted as saying that was one of the pieces of work you were most proud of.
Yeah.
And it's got quite a funny backstory.
Yeah, it made me go on, share it with us.
Oh,
I have to be careful about this because it's an old friend.
Could be a family audience.
Yeah. Oh, how do you say it if it's a family audience? Anyway, okay, I'll try and work it out. So, this guy we knew used to bunk off at work and stay at home. And when his wife was not at home.
Now, your medicine's in the cupboard. I'll be back at 6. Keep the place tidy. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And he used to enjoy himself without knowledge of his wife, because his wife would not approve of that sort of thing.
Hi, big boy. You want me, don't you? Say you love me.
I love you.
And we based the commercial on him. We used to say, one day she's going to come back and catch you in mid-throws, as it were. And we used to play act, because she was Scottish, play act and be her catching him out. And me and Al used to always tease him about it. So when we came up with the idea, we very much had that in mind.
Don't look at me!
What are you doing?
Run away! Run away! Don't look at
Don't
me!
Put the floor
Troubles with Apple Seduction. Beautifully well told, I think. You told that sensationally. I think that was quite a challenge
from me to you.
But those You've Been Tangoed adverts that you did before you started your own place hit us all in the face in the 90s. Yeah. We've got a clip, so let's just have a listen.
Okay.
Hello, Tony. I think we might use a video replay here.
Super, Ralph. Let's do that.
Oh, yes! We could be in for a quintessential tango taste sensation here. Oh, I don't think he was expecting that.
Ralph, I don't think we was expecting that either.
What a titanic embodiment of the hit! Oh, of real oranges.
Yes, Ralph. Lovely.
You know where you've been tangoed.
Oh, that brings back so many memories for me, Trevor. How about for you when you listen to that kind of thing?
It's really quite funny because I'm amazed by the amount of people who remember it. And I remember I had to do a talk at National Film Theatre, and one of the subjects was this film, these ads that we did. And like the amount of people that came up to me afterwards and just started saying, oh, I was at school, we were doing it, or doing this or doing that. It's quite funny. It seemed to really stay with people. That's the thing I'm most proud about, doing work that people not just like. It's great that they like the work, and it's not just selling. It's something that becomes entertainment, and it becomes a part of people's lives. And it's like a good music track. You know, you can place yourself where you were when you first heard it. So I'm very proud. And also, I wouldn't have been able to open my own business. I wouldn't be able to do a lot of those things if we didn't do those tango ads and the pot noodle work. It kind of really defined me and Al and made quite a name for us. And it made it harder for people to fire us as well, because before then I'd been fired by every job I've ever been at. So it was like our bosses kind of presumed that we were being sought after by lots of people, which we weren't, but it made us more valued.
So was it the success of ads like that that led you to start Quiet Storm and have your own agency?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I had no intention of running my own agency. And it's like I had other people doing stuff like that. I didn't want to do it, to be honest. I was quite happy just to be, you know, sit at my desk. But what happened was I started wanting to write and direct my own work. And weirdly enough, there was no agencies in London doing that. There's a guy in Amsterdam that me and Al loved his work, and we found out that he wrote and directed his work, and it was like, wow. I've always been a film head since I've been a kid, love movies and directors. I remember there was people like Tarantino and Spike Lee coming through at the time, both writing and directing their work. I thought, God, I'd love to do that. And people started asking me to direct things or to be an out-and-out director. And I didn't want to be that. I wanted to be able to still be a creative, because I love coming up with ideas and being a part of the idea. But it seemed at that stage you either left advertising like Frank Budgen did and become an exceptional director, which he was. And I always thought, I'm not particularly a fantastic director, but I think the combination of me coming up with my own ideas and being able to push them on a day-to-day basis and even push them at the editing stage and working with actors, one, it's fun. Two, it allows me to escalate my ideas better. But they weren't really up for me writing and directing my own work. So my creative partner at the time, my producer wanted us to out and out direct. We said, we don't want to do that, but we want to start up our own agency. And she came with us, and Al came with me, and my ex-wife came in on the financial side. And we all set off to start this up. But as soon as I started it up, my producer said, I spoke to my lawyer. He told me it's not a good idea to lose my name. So she decided not to do it after we left. She still gave us a little office because she wanted us to direct. And Al went through lots of years with me and him on the dole. And I think losing that security of not being within a big agency and being looked after, he went back to Hal Henry. And so it was just me left and my ex-wife, which the pressure in the end, I think, was one of the reasons our marriage broke up, because it was very stressful running an advertising agency. Then I ended up having this baby, and I didn't really even know what to call it. So I based it on an old club that I used to always get rejected from. They wouldn't let me in, and they really didn't like me. They didn't like the look of me. And some of my mates would go in, and I couldn't, but it was called Quiet Storm. And I thought, when I had to come up with an agency name, I thought, oh yeah, I'll call it Quiet Storm. And everybody seemed to like it. It didn't sound all advertising-y like Robinson and Robinson, or, you know, like everybody at that stage seemed to make it sound like you were in a bank. So I chose the name Quiet Storm, and all the people in the company liked it as well.
Quiet Storm, I think, is a lovely name. I mean, indulge us. Tell us about some of the most well-known ads, or your favourite ads, or, again, the ones that you're most proud of.
Oh, God, it's been a while now. So, obviously, I really like the stuff that you get to give back a bit. And Kate, my old producer, came in one time angry at this concept of, you know, sex trafficking. And it was round about, I mean, we worked in Soho, so it was all around us. And I hadn't really thought about it. We went and did some interviews with these girls, and then we went, right, we're going to try and do something about it. And that Helen Bamber got us in to do some advertising for them. And I did an installation where we recreated one of these girls' rooms in a big cargo thing that would ship the women out. And it just was the most spookiest room. We had the sound effects from a film called Irreversible. If you ever see that film, you'd kind of realize how creepy the sound effects was. And we had a bed on hydraulics, so it would look like somebody invisible was having to do on that bed. And we had a sink that would run and steam up the glass, and written on the glass, we had written, "Help me." And we had all this whole thing, even the wallpaper that we had, when you look closely, it had these horrible pornographic imageries at the wallpaper, but you wouldn't see it straight away. And so we created this room that was trying to portray even the smell. Actually, we got a perfumer specialist to create a perfume, a mixture of kind of what it smells like in one of those rooms, perfume and various other odors. And so the whole room was really oppressive and horrible, but it was great because people walking into the installation and instantly getting that these women were having to sleep with up to 40 men a day. And this is their life. They're trapped in these rooms because they've been kidnapped and been brought to these environments. That was a really good experience because it's like, I love being able to think not just about a poster or a TV ad, but if you can really emotionally persuade people and let them see through your eyes in terms of what you're trying to achieve, what you're trying to say to people. That's what I love about advertising. And poor Kate, one night, was working late on it because it was a real rush to get this thing up and running. It was in Trafalgar Square, this huge installation. We had four other artists as well had their own thing. So you had to walk through it like a train, had to walk through each installation, which is horrible. And poor Kate got locked in the installation all night in there. She was in there late one night and she got locked in. And so I thought, oh my God. She said, yeah. She said, because the music was going the whole night, she felt like she's going insane.
That's properly immersive for her. Poor thing.
Yes.
So you're working from home at the moment, like many of us are, with Quiet Storm CEO, your wife, Rania.
Yes.
What's it like working together? And do you have a really good yin and yang going, do you think?
Oh, yeah. I think we've always had that in terms of, because I can't do the stuff that Rania does at all. I'm pretty bad at lots of things. And even pretty bad at doing the home life thing as well. She's got that all, and I think I stress her out as well because she just says that I just swan around being a creative director, which I probably do because I'm not very good at doing anything else. And she's just the button down one in us. She's the one that really gets things happening, and she deals with all our PR in a company and all those kind of stuff that it just seems to happen to me as opposed to somebody behind it. She's incredibly smart and knows what she's doing. But I must say it has been stressful as late because that's my dog, believe it or not.
There's your dog making an appearance.
Scratching on the door. Hopefully somebody will pick up on that. Oh, yeah, Rania's got that.
Good. You see, Rania's ahead of everything.
Yeah,
really, isn't
she's
she?
On it.
No wonder she's the CEO.
Yeah. Well, you know what? She deserves it. We was going through some pretty horrible times about 6 years ago, and I brought her in to help me on a pitch, and then she just never left. But she's been really good for the building of Quiet Storm. If you look at us, we've really flourished in the last 6 years. Even in a horrible pandemic year, we've done quite well, and we were able to work on projects that really was about just treading water and just making sure we could survive. But we ended up revitalizing Create Not Hate, which I started over 13 years ago. And I brought it back.
I want to talk to you about Create Not Hate. You started it, I think, in 2007, didn't you, originally?
Yeah.
What triggered it in the first place?
What it was, I've always felt a bit guilty being in advertising and having such a long and fruitful and fun career. And I knew I grew up around people more talented than me, more intelligent than me, just really smart people, but they never knew about advertising. They all had the same career officers that I had, so they didn't have any idea about the possibilities and that they could really have such a brilliant career. And on the other hand as well, the advertising industry wasn't really aware of them. I thought I was going to be the beginning, I don't know why, the beginning of the advertising industry. Well, if he's doing all this stuff with his partner, we need to get more people of diversity in the industry. So I was expecting to see the floodgates and expecting to see a lot more of me, better than me in the industry. And it didn't seem to happen. It's every now and again you saw someone, the odd person, and it would disappear again. So I really wanted to go back, and I chose my old school because I wanted subject matter that the kids would get straight away. And I saw in the news, funny enough, at my old school, a kid was stabbed to death. So I wanted to use that subject matter of knife and gun crime and trying to, and at the same time, I remember somebody seeing a poster coming. I think this was for heroin, but they had this different degrees of this woman getting worse and a lovely smart line. And I remember thinking, that's a lovely ad, and I think it won awards and stuff like that. But I remember thinking, that's not going to stop. It's like putting people's horrible cancerous things on a box and expecting people are going to stop smoking because of those imagery. And I thought, if you're really going to try and stop these kids from carrying knives, you need to go back and talk to the kids that who is really affecting, who living in day-to-day fear of being stabbed to death. So I went back to my old school and set them the brief. And that was, I managed to do it for about 2 years. And like the one piece of work that was made that I had to invest in myself, because I was paying for it all myself and getting all my staff to work on it for nothing. But through it, got quite a few of the kids into advertising. I don't know what they all did now. The one that I know, because I'm still friends with him, is Dennis, who co-directed the films with me. And he went on to work with Idris Elba. That got me a taste for this can work. And I got a lot from it emotionally as well, which I didn't anticipate actually, because I don't really see myself as a teacher nurturing type of person. So I was quite surprised how much reward I got from doing it. So that was why I started it originally.
And do you think where we are today in 2021, is the industry more diverse, or have we not come very far, do you think?
I don't think we've come very far at all. You just need to look around. Even looking around my own office, I have to go out my way to try and look at how we recruit. And Ryan has been brilliant. I thought Create Not Hate really needed to raise its head again, because especially after I felt really, and both my wife felt powerless and I felt incredibly angry. I've not been that angry for a while when George Floyd was murdered. And it just really knocked me sideways. But rather than being angry, I thought, you know what, there's something I can do. And I just, you know, it's no point in looking to others to change things. It's really down to me. I'm in a great position of power. Kids will respect me when I come in and kind of go, look, I've been in the industry a long time, da, 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 da. So I thought I had to bring back Create Not Hate. But this time I was lucky because I had Rania with me and we just planned it a lot better. And we've approached clients as well, and we approached advertising people to try this, and we want to make it more sustainable this time as well. But the work this time round, I mean, the subject matter was racism. That again was a subject matter that I knew the kids could grasp very quickly. These kids range from 14 to about 23 years old, and none of them were schooled in advertising in any shape or form. So I had to find something that they could instantly get. But I was really amazed by the amount of work and great ideas that came out from these groups with these kids. And also these kids were living it. On the way to the session, these kids were being stopped and searched. And like one of them was saying, it was one of the mums of the kids was saying to us, look at his wrist. He's still got the cuff marks. They cuffed him, handcuffed him while they searched him, let them go. But this is a kid in his school uniform. And they were stopping and searching these kids. And like she said, it was ironic because they were stood. It was in Daniel area, actually, Notting Hill. And they were saying Labrick Grove. And it was Acton. Black Lives Matter poster up as they were being stopped and searched. It was really,
that's outrageous.
Really fun.
We've heard similar stories from Patrick Hutchinson, the Black Lives Matter hero who saved the life of the white protester.
Oh, yeah, that guy.
And off the back of that, you know, that one image that was captured by Reuters of him carrying him to safety and basically saving his life, he's formed UKAI, United to Change and Inspire, which actually I'm now an ambassador of. I was so taken with what Patrick's done. But he's used that one image as a platform for change. And I just wonder whether you think the momentum for change and the sense of urgency off the back of George Floyd's dreadful murder is here to stay, or, you know, do we sort of slip back into times we shouldn't stay?
That's a question I can't answer. The only thing that I'm trying to do is, I'm not looking for others for change, to be honest. I'm looking for myself to cause the change and be the active motivation. As long as I'm willing to take the knee, as it were, and try and do something to change things, I think that's all I can rely on, really. People are just going to get bored with it, I guess, and people are going to not want to hear it anymore. It's just like seeing the starving kids on the TV. You feel terrible. You feel your heart wrenched, but at the same time, you're like going, oh, I don't want to think about it anymore. It's not affecting me. But I'm hoping people will start with their own kids and start with educating and start with trying to, like, I've seen a great shift with the amount of women that's in advertising from when I first came in. So there were PAs and you never saw strategists, you never saw account women. There was a couple of account women, but now it feels like a better balance. And we need to do that with diversity.
What, on the diversity front, what advice do you have for young people when you're talking to them, you know, young people who hope to make their living in the creative industry? Do you give them examples from the experience and your well-trodden path?
Yeah, I mean, like, yes, but also I try not to, this is what I've done. One day you could be as good as me. I try not to do that. I try to enhance on what they're good at doing and try to listen to them in terms of what they think their strengths are. I try to prepare them for the door to be slammed in their face a lot. I try to prepare them for when you walk in these environments, sometimes you are, well, most of the times you're the only black face in the room. And I went to a party and it was a big club night. And I was there with some of my friends who were white, and they were in this huge room full of black people dancing around. And I could see the kind of, you know, they got a black friend in me, but you could see them just look kind of like, oh my God, and be intimidated by this environment. And I was thinking, God, this is what I have to do every day most of the time, is going into meetings with boards. You know, I remember having to do a talk for journalists, and it's just a sea of white faces. And I just remember feeling really intimidated and out of sorts. And I think I just tried to prepare the kids for, listen, there's going to be moments like this. There's going to be moments when you, and just trying as much as possible, build their confidence in terms of, and their preparation for them dealing with different situations. And obviously, I try to encourage them as much as possible and try to steer them into meeting the right people. And I try to get some of my friends to give them placements and do talks and let them come in and do editing and stuff like that so they can get a taste, normally around a subject like we was doing with the racism. But eventually I just can't wait to just get them working. And we've got some clients interested just to get them working on normal stuff like baked beans and stuff like that, which, you know, that's where it comes a lot harder.
What more normal stuff have you been working on that front? Anything that we'll have seen on the telly or any of our favourite brands that you've been working with?
I'm trying to think, actually. God, you stumped me there. Recently, we've been seen to be pitching a lot. We're just doing, I think I'm able to say this, but we won a Google, bit of Google Black Pound Day. So that's a really fantastic thing to be involved with. And so we're just trying to get all that stuff made up now. And because Google's vast, and it's, you realize, because Haribo, especially in the early days, was easy. I just sold the idea to Herwig. And if Herwig sent it to the top guys, it was done. But Google's got so much different people that have to get, you know, verification. And it's a dodgy subject to be telling people to shop at black shops, because it's a bit like when you say Black Lives Matter, they work, then people go, oh, well, all lives matter, you know, and they don't quite get it's quite, being as a black business, I know you get a lot of problems being black and walking into a bank and trying to get a loan and trying to get a start and trying to be supported, especially when you look like me and got locks and stuff. So black businesses do struggle a lot and they can fall through the cracks very easily. So it's a brilliant thing to encourage everyone, not just black people, everyone, to just every now and again shop for one day, shop black, because it will really help. So that's been a really important and fun thing to be working on.
That sounds an amazing thing. I'm still reeling from the fact that you said there was that sign where you grew up, you know, when you said no dogs, no blacks. Just makes my blood run cold. It's quite unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, it was just on the door. It'd been there for as long as the pub been open. And it was just like, but I remember thinking about a lot of stuff that's happened to me in the past, because I'm so old now.
No,
it feels
not.
Like it happened to somebody else. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like some of the incidents I used to have when I was a kid growing up. And I'm just so glad I managed to stay alive, actually. A lot of the situations, most of them were made by myself, I think. I was always the one. Always remember walking out on the high road on a Sunday morning, really sunny day. It was me and my friends. There's about five of us walking up the road. And we were teenagers, and we were all laughing and happy. And this massive, two bikers, one was huge, and one was a little fella. And the little fella, of course, walked straight up to me and barged me in the chest. And I said to him, look, it's a lovely sunny day. Why are you trying to pick a fight? And the big one just punched me in the eye. And my eye instantly swelled up. And I remember thinking at the time, what is it about me that they always make a beeline for me? And I still haven't, I think it works in my favor. It has worked in my favor going forward, because I think I've been very lucky and I've had lots of things come to me in the end.
I don't know why they made a beeline for you. I bet that beautiful smile's got you out of lots of situations that I've been looking at on our Zoom conversation. Final thought, Trev. I just wondered what you think your poor old careers advisor would have made of your OBE for services to the advertising world, as well as the incredible work you've done on trying to improve diversity in your industry.
I don't know. I'll tell you what I do know. An old teacher of mine, and she's my favourite teacher at my primary school, Miss Blythe, right? I always remember her last name, Brenda Blythe. And she tracked me down after seeing me pop up on a TV screen. And it was so sweet. I took her out to Groucho Club for dinner and just caught up on her life. And she was telling me how proud she was of me. And she's told me something that absolutely moved me and chilled me. She was really worried about me because you see how talented I was at school, at primary school, I knew her. And then when I went to secondary school, she told the teachers, this guy is really talented, he's really, try and look after him. And she went and told my teachers at the school, because I do remember a point when there was a shift, how they were talking to me at school. I think it was 13, and I thought, right, I'm going to make something of my life. But I had this guardian angel of my old teacher, Miss Blythe. You know, it's lovely to see her again.
Well, we shall end on your guardian angel and teacher, Miss Blythe. I have to say, Trevor, it's been an absolute joy chatting to you today. And I hope when life resumes some kind of normality, we can meet up and hear some of your stories over a glass of wine.
Yes, that would be amazing. Get you and your hubby out. We can I'll bring Rania out as well.
Oh, yeah, let her out. She's working hard and she's looking after the dog now as well.
In fact, I'm going to keep her in here after lockdown commences. I'm just going to keep her at home.
Oh, we want to meet her. Thank you so much for doing
it. Yeah, she's good. You should get her on. She's brilliant. She's a lot more eloquent than me.
Is she? Now you tell us, Now we've finished the podcast.
No. Did another one with her. She's got some brilliant stories about coming to this country, not speaking a word of English and having to work and grow up in Constable Land and the racism and all the stuff that she grew up with. And she went through the same clubbing era as me as well. So she's got a different side to the coin.
Well, we'll feature that at some point. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Trevor Robinson, OBE, founder of Quiet Storm and the brains behind Create Not Hate. If you'd like to see some of Trevor's work, then go to quietstorm.co.uk. And for more about his campaign, go to createnothate.org. Thanks very much for listening. Don't forget you can download and subscribe to The Convex Conversation at convex.podbean.com or find us on Spotify, Apple and Google Podcasts, or just ask Alexa. That's it from me. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.